I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Let's be honest about this. Although there's been an embargo on relations with Cuba for close to 44 years, it hasn't been that hard to visit. Many Americans have flown in illegally through Canada or the Caribbean. Many others, especially in the past decade, have taken advantage of educational tours and cultural visits. Under President Clinton, the Treasury Department was approving trips to study dancing, music, and baseball, as well as all those exchanges for more serious scholars. Well, it's all about to change. Republicans in the White House and in Florida have been slowly tightening up on travel. The White House recently announced that cultural and educational travel licenses for Cuba will not be renewed. Though they won't come right out and say it, word is that people were having too much fun in Cuba. But there's more. The politics of Cuban Americans and stiffened support for the embargo are becoming features of a get-tough White House. An aide to the president's brother, Jeb, the man who's governor of Florida, put it this way, quote, "Castro would be foolhardy to mess with a resolute George W. Bush. The administration has taken care of one tyrant already." Connection listeners, is it a good time to once again pull the Iron Curtain closed around the island of Cuba? If the embargo hasn't shaken Castro after 44 years, why keep it in place? Who suffers here? Castro? Cubans? Or Americans? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we have with us on the program today two Cuban-American scholars who will speak specifically to these issues. I'd like to go first, though, to Terry Carl. Terry's a professor of political science at the Institute for International Studies at Stanford University, and she's also a lecturer on the educational tour to Cuba, sponsored by Stanford University's Alumni Association. So, Terry, I guess you've been on a few of these trips to Cuba.
I've been on many of them, very many of them. I just returned, actually.
Now, where do you come down on this? If someone says to you there's too much rum drinking, too much cigar smoking, you guys need to get serious about your education, is that a reasonable charge?
Well, we go to the beach on our Stanford tour. We stand at the beach of the Bay of Pigs, and I give a lecture on the history of U.S.-Cuban relations, standing at the spot where the U.S. invaded to try to overthrow the government of Cuba. And that's how we visit the beach at Stanford. In my view, rather than having so much fun, what we do is we learn the story of U.S.-Cuban relations, which is also a way of learning about ourselves. And we learn, I think, that this restricts the freedom of information and ideas, the exchange between American citizens and Cubans, that it hurts families on both sides of the Florida Straits, and that it really works not only to hurt the economy of the United States, but to impede the prospects for better U.S.-Cuban relations in the years to come, in the years after Fidel Castro, and in the period of time that we need to be thinking about what is going to come ahead for a country that is right on our border.
Now, these exchanges are called people-to-people exchanges. So when you're doing them, are you focused specifically on what Americans are getting out of it? Are you also paying attention to what it means to the Cubans who are a part of these tours?
Well, my job, I'm not the tour director. My job is the professor to teach what I call a short course about Cuba, which also has information about the rest of Latin America. Cuba's a place that has, in my view, perhaps the most interesting history in Latin America. It was the last colony of Spain, which means that the Spanish influence there is very, very strong. You can go to a place called Trinidad, which was founded in the early 1500s, and you can really see the history of the sugar industry, which is the history of slavery. It is the history of how people came not only to Cuba but to the United States. It has a story in it which I think is an extremely important story to us, contemporary story, which is about efforts to promote democracy abroad. Cuba is the very first place at the turn of the 20th century, where the United States tried for the very first time to promote democracy, something that's right in the news today in Iraq. It's important for people to see what happened in our first and earliest efforts, and what went wrong, what went right. So we stand, for example, at the Capitol building in Havana, which was built in the, built at the height of the sugar boom and which was the symbol of Cuban democracy. And I give in that spot, along with Cuban historians and architects who also work with us and work with us on our trips, I give a talk on what this building symbolizes, what it means, what happened inside this building. We go into rooms where people can look at which speech was given where. We stand at the tomb of Jose Marti, and we talk about what he means, what he symbolizes in Cuba for Cubans on the right and for Cubans on the left, why he's such an important figure.
Now, Terry, if I can just interrupt you for
sure.
a minute. You know full well that at the same time that you're doing this, there are people on salsa dancing tours and baseball tours, or there have been people on tours like this, as well as thousands of Americans who will, you know, fly in through Mexico City or Freeport against the government's wishes. What actually came about to change all this? Why is it that the scholars are being swept up at the same time as the sort of holiday makers and on all this travel's being closed down? What's your belief there?
Well, 2 points on this. First of all, the salsa dancing, we don't do these kinds of trips, but the baseball, the dancing, the music, Cuba is culturally in the lead in these things. I think anybody who's seen the Buena Vista Social Club knows that. The history of mambo, the history of dance that came from slavery. It's hard to separate what dancing is, what dancing trip is a dancing trip because people are having fun, and what dancing trip is a dancing trip because Cuba, in fact, has made an enormous contribution to the music and culture of Latin America.
Okay, but is it American politics that's shutting this door?
Right, but that's just one issue. How do you even distinguish between those two issues? But the bottom line is that this isn't about Cuba at all. This is about elections in Florida, and it will remain about elections in Florida. The Bush administration won Florida. We all know what kind of a story that was, so I don't have to repeat that. The Bush administration won Florida by a hair. It believes that it can only win Florida with the organized support of Cuban Americans and with the money and lobbying of major Cuban American relations institutions. The problem with this, for the Bush administration, by the way, is that Cuban Americans, by all polls that we do, particularly the Miami Herald polls, are a divided group. They do not feel the same way about restricting Cuba. And the big interesting change is that those Cuban Americans who came in the 1960s and the early 70s and who control the politics and the political apparatus of Cuban Americans in Miami are hardliners. They want to squeeze Cuba. They want to squeeze Cuban people because they believe that's a way to get rid of Fidel Castro. But those people who come in the 80s and 90s, by a very different set of opinions and votes, don't want to do that. They favor reconciliation. They do not favor a travel ban. They have the majority of them overwhelmingly want to negotiate better relations with Cuba and stop punitive moves towards Cuba.
Terry, I actually have a couple of these people just standing by to talk to us, and I think what I'll do is move to them now.
Great.
And thank you for your perspectives on the educational tour. Thanks for being with us. Terry Carles, a professor of political science at Stanford University. As I mentioned earlier in the program, I have with me Gustavo Perez Firmat. He's professor of humanities at Columbia University and a Cuban-American poet and writer. He's joining us from a studio in North Carolina. And Delia Poe, who is assistant professor of Spanish at Florida State University. She regularly travels to Cuba to visit her family and to research gender issues in Cuba. She's joining us from a studio in Tallahassee. Welcome to both of you.
Hello.
Good morning.
I want to begin, if I can, with you, Gustavo. You had a chance to listen to Terry sort of turn the page to this being about politics rather than being about the embargo and Cuban-American relations. Do you agree with that?
No. I think Terry's eloquent presentation, illustrates precisely what's wrong with these so-called educational tours. She went on for 10 minutes and not once mentioned the fact that Cuba is currently living under a 44-year-old dictatorship. And it seems to me odd to talk about the situation of elections in South Florida when there haven't been free elections in Cuba in 44 years. So I wonder when Terry stands on the Bay of Pigs and talks about the U.S. invasion of the island, what kind of information these students are really getting. She said, for example, that at the Bay of Pigs, the U.S. invaded Cuba. That is inaccurate. A bunch of Cuban exiles backed by the U.S. invaded Cuba. And so, you know, obviously, you know, people who go to Cuba and who, and by the way, I haven't been back to Cuba, get, you know, one perspective, not a complete perspective. If they wanted a complete educational perspective, perhaps they should visit the jails where Castro recently, you know, rounded up, you know, dozens of independent journalists and gave them rather heavy jail sentences. Or perhaps they should visit what we call the paredón. The paredón is the wall against which they execute people, as they did the other day with three young men. So
these are the men who were trying to hijack a ferry, is that right?
Exactly. That was their crime. They tried to leave Cuba by hijacking a ferry. Nobody was injured in their hijacking attempt. They were caught. They were they had a one-day trial, and they were executed 2 days later.
Gustavo, I want you to just stand by for half a sec, because I'd like to hear from Delia before we go to a break, which is coming up. Delia, two very different perspectives here. Should all contact between Cubans and Americans be curtailed in the way that it appears the Bush administration would like to see it done?
Well, I think the key term there is all contact. No, not all contact should be curtailed. First, I think it's impossible because Americans will travel to Cuba legally or illegally. But also there is contact with the island that I think is necessary. Not only necessary, but really building a foundation for eventually a transition in Cuba to democracy.
Is that family contact or educational contact? What are you talking about?
I'm talking about both.
Yeah.
Certainly family contact has been around, and it's very strong. That is not being curtailed by the administration because
right.
It's under very different accords. They're called humanitarian travel. That's a different issue. And actually, those flights leave through charters from Miami, from the New York area, and from California, I believe. Those are for families to reunite. That's how I traveled to Cuba.
Right.
Also, educational contact, I think, and cultural contact is also important. I agree with Gustavo that some of these educational programs are very one-sided. However, on the whole, I think their benefits far outweigh their downside. That is, the person-to-person contact with Cuba, I think, is so valuable that that it should remain open. Particularly when we're talking about culture.
All right, stop there for half a sec because we have to take a short break and we will talk about whether or not things are better open or closed. Connection listeners, we're talking about educational and cultural exchanges with Cuba, what's gained and what's lost with this people-to-people travel to Cuba. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. We'd like to have you in on the conversation when we come back after the break. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. My name's Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. The Bush administration has announced that it is drawing an end to educational and cultural exchanges between Americans and Cubans because of the manner in which some of those tours and trips were being managed. And we're using that as an opportunity to look at relations between America and Cuba, what that travel does and does not do for people in both countries. With me on the program today, Gustavo Perez Firmat. He was born in Havana, Cuba, raised in Miami, Florida. He's a professor of humanities at Columbia University. He's also a poet and a writer. His book, Next Year in Cuba, was nominated for the Pulitzer Prize a few years back. Delia Poe is also with us. She's an assistant professor of Spanish at Florida State University, a Cuban-American scholar and writer who is editor of the most recent book, Iguana Dreams. And Gustavo, maybe I can come back to you and get a definition from you of, in your mind, what's acceptable. Do you want zero contact? Do you want only family contact? What do you think is appropriate now?
Well, I have very mixed feelings about this. I think that certainly, I believe as a matter of, in general, that the more free flow of information there is back and forth to Cuba, the worse it is for the regime. I'm not convinced that Castro actually would like to see the embargo lifted. There is a theory that the reason Castro cracks down on dissidents every once in a while is precisely to stop efforts to lift the embargo in the United States. And about the embargo himself, I'm sort of conflicted. And I think that arguments on both sides tend to be somewhat disingenuous. People on the left say that the embargo should be lifted because it targets the wrong people. It just hurts the Cuban people and does nothing about the government. However,
you're saying that's only partly right.
Right. At least some of those people, I think, also believe that if the embargo were lifted, it would help the survival of the Cuban government. People on the right, like myself, are in favor of the embargo because we say it's going to help topple the regime. Well, as you and Terry pointed out, you know, after 44 years, obviously the embargo is not a very good weapon against the regime. What we're not willing to admit is that, because it's not a good political argument, is our attachment to the embargo is really sentimental or symbolic.
Is it?
We want the embargo.
Are you saying that it is a sentimental or nostalgic attachment to the embargo?
Yes, it's a sentimental or symbolic attachment to the embargo. We want the embargo. You know, Cuban exiles sort of feel quite often sort of abandoned by history. We realize that we lost. And this especially applies to the older generation of exiles, my parents' generation. Mm. And the embargo is a symbol of the fact that the United States is on our side. No, that at least, you know, they say that we were right to leave. And so I think that the arguments on both sides, they tend to be confused because people are not really, you know, the arguments are made, the stated reasons to be in favor or against are somewhat different from the real reasons to be in favor or against. Am I in favor or against the embargo? On the one hand, I think that the worst thing that could happen to the regime would be to have total, complete, free flow of people, products, and information back and forth, which would include, in these people-to-people exchanges, that would have to include Cuban people coming to the United States, mm-hmm. Cuban young men and women coming to American universities. That's not anything that happens now. Okay. On the other hand, you know, as a sort of right-wing Cuban from Miami, I understand why we are so attached sentimentally to the idea of the embargo.
Now, Delia, I understand that even in your case, in your family, you get into arguments about is the embargo a good thing or a bad thing?
Yes, I think Gustavo has pointed out that that the embargo and just Cuba in general, contact with Cuba, is an emotional topic, and it is split across generations. I am second generation. That is, I was not born in Cuba, and that already sets me apart from Gustavo's generation, mm-hmm. Even though we're not that far apart in age. My parents left in 1961, so they left very early on. And within my family, when the subject of the embargo comes up, it is very emotional and very heated. And I think Gustavo has clearly put his finger on it in that that sometimes it is not about what is rational or what the data shows us. Sometimes it is just an emotional attachment to a certain line of thinking. Because I do agree with Gustavo that probably if we want to topple the Castro regime, putting an end to the embargo would do it faster. For many reasons. One of them is that he's right in that Castro does use the embargo as an excuse, mm-hmm. Instead of admitting that the revolution has failed in so many ways, he can point to the embargo and say, the revolution would be a success were it not for U.S. policy. So I think the embargo is used as a divisive tool. And probably if the embargo were to end, the Castro regime would end soon after that.
or put in an embargo in order,
yes,
to, in order
right,
to stay in power. Our number is 1-800-423-8255.
It already has an embargo of its own. Cuban young men and women are not allowed to come to study in this country, for example.
All right. Thanks for pointing that out, because we always just focus on, of course, on the policy in this country. Let's take our first call from Boston. Now, Zev's on the line. Hi, Zev.
Hello. I am the son of a Cuban immigrant who had to flee Cuba in 61, and I would like to say I agree with all of Gustavo's points, especially about the conflict of the embargo, because I believe the embargo should be lifted because Castro just uses it as a crux for his failure. But in talking about the cultural exchanges, the greatest danger that I see there for United States students is that it's used as a propaganda machine by the Cuban government.
Zev, have you been to Cuba?
I actually have been to Cuba.
Did you go on one of these exchanges?
No, I went by myself to see where my mother came from.
Yeah.
And I could tell you that, you know, I grew up in Miami, and always hearing the Cubans, Americans, or talk about Cuba, I didn't realize the suffering that the Cubans had. And I'm sure many of the places that I went to, the students are not taken. I think a point is a lot of the propaganda is distorted. For example, one of my friends who goes to MIT MBA, he went on one of these cultural exchanges, and he starts giving me all these statistics about Cuba today, how well there's a doctor, you know, for every 100 people, and the literacy rate. But yeah, everybody can read, but they read. You know, they read propaganda. They can only read, communist Fidel doctrine. Or they might have a doctor for every 100 people, but the doctors don't have the tools that they need. I visited a synagogue in Cuba, and there was only one room that was air-conditioned, and that was just used to keep medication.
All right. The part about this that I'd like to actually bring back to Gustavo is that the point, Zev, thanks for your call. And the points that you're making, Gustavo, the point that you made is that people will buy whatever propaganda they're presented with. I mean, I know people who went to the Soviet Union and were taken on these tours saying, you know, isn't ours a wonderful country? And I know people who've been to Cuba and been shown the healthcare system and, you know, isn't ours a wonderful country? Do you really think people buy that? Do you think that sort of propaganda isn't in the long run self-defeating?
I think you're right in the long run. I think in the short run, some do and some don't. I have, you know, many, many students. The odd thing about my classes on Cuban literature at Columbia and elsewhere is that, you know, these kids have been to Cuba and I haven't. And so I've had a lot of students who've been to Cuba, and some of them come back and say, you know, and understand, number one, the extent to which their visit to Cuba was managed and controlled. Others come back. For example, I had a student not long ago who came back, and one day she says to me, look, you know, I know that Cuba is a dictatorship. I know that there is no freedom there. But they all look so happy. And, that's the other reaction. So that, I think just on anecdotal evidence from talking to a lot of students who've been to Cuba, I think the overall effect, though not the purpose of these educational tours, is to create goodwill toward a totalitarian regime. I also was talking to another student recently who had gone to Havana, to the University of Havana, on a well-known program, and had taken a course on contemporary Cuban history. And I asked her at one point if she had ever been told about the UMAP camps. Those, as I say, that is an important event in Cuba's recent history, concentration camps in the 60s, in which homosexuals were put. And she said no, that the Cuban instructor had not at all talked about the UMAP camps. So
I'll tell you something, Gustavo. My daughter, who studies at a Canadian university and holds a Canadian passport and is taking a minor in Spanish, is in Cuba as we speak on exactly that same course that you're describing, and is getting exactly the same sort of happy tour of Cuba that you're describing. In fact, on the evening before May Day, their Cuban guides got them up at 3 o'clock in the morning in order to take them to the square where Fidel Castro was going to speak. And, you know, isn't this just a wonderful moment for the country? And it's partly on the basis of hearing her speak about that that made me want to say, you know, but people get it. People get that this is a propaganda tour. I don't know. I mean, maybe they need someone like you to make those, or me, to make those reminders, though.
Well, that's one of my missions in life to set them straight, you know.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Next to Hopkinton, Massachusetts, and Frank's with us. Hi, Frank.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
I traveled to Cuba last summer as a part of a graduate study for Cambridge College.
A legal trip?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I was studying solar energy and the way Cuba was trying to utilize it and how they were refurbishing old Havana and what they were doing out in the country. And we had free access to everywhere we wanted to go.
How do you know?
There was one instance in Las Teresas where they were showing me an old solar water, hot water heating plant.
Yeah.
And I wasn't supposed to be shown how broken down it was, and guards came over, but they were like maintenance men guards. And that was the one instance where I noticed there was any stopping me of anything, because any other time I was able to look everywhere I wanted.
Okay, but you're also a grown-up with a good idea of what you were getting into and, mm-hmm. and knew what to look for. Frank, I want to turn to Delia in just half a sec, but before I do, a question for you about, you know, who you saw benefiting from your visit to Cuba. Was it just what you were able to see and conclude about the country, or was there also some benefit for the Cubans that you met while you were there?
We met Cubans at many different levels, and we met some hardliners that were higher up educators that were dedicated to the revolution and proud of it. And yeah, they have done a lot of good. We met everyday people. I was proudest of a connection I made. Going there as a student, making a connection with people was, I think, important. We should continue doing that. Europeans can travel to Cuba unfettered, and it's just Americans that can't travel to there. Yes, we should have Cuba be free, and Castro has done a lot of good, and he's done a lot of bad. But we should. They really look up to us. They have a lot of American TV looking for solar panels on roofs. I saw more satellite TV dishes. They have a lot of American influence, a lot of American television and propaganda. But they really do look up to us on a personal level, and they look to us for friendship.
All right. Frank, thanks a lot for your call.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Dealey, it's a good point that Frank makes about the fact that there's lots of Europeans there, and there's lots of Canadians, and there's lots of other people from Latin America. So the idea that withholding the money or the charms of the American traveler is somehow going to have a serious impact on the country is becoming a little bit of a weak argument, isn't it?
Yes. Also, I think that earlier in the show, right now with your conversation with Gustavo, you were focusing on what the American students got out of these visits.
Right.
And granted, a lot of times it is very limited. I think our last caller was probably a good example of how if the traveler is curious and a bit more adventurous, they could get a lot more out of that trip, mm-hmm. and they could also get different points of view. I think that the cultural and educational exchanges are controlled. They're controlled to a point, though, in that students generally are allowed to go freely about, free. You know, they have some free time to go about the city, go about or the town or wherever they happen to be visiting, and engage in conversations with everyday Cubans. So I think American travelers get as much as they want to get, or as much as they're looking to get out of these travels. But I think the real benefit is to Cubans. My experience in traveling to Cuba is that because there are European, Latin American tourists and so on, but not a lot of American tourists, Americans draw a lot of attention. And a lot of Cubans who don't have a lot of opportunities for contact with outsiders they have a great deal of misinformation about the United States and about Americans and about American culture. Imagine if you only see three television shows and try to, from there, get a picture of American culture. It would be very strange. Mm-hmm. So they have a lot of questions. And I think that's the real opportunity. Gustavo was saying that he always wants to set people straight, you know, give them complete information. And travel to Cuba could allow Americans to also combat the misinformation that Cubans get about the United States. The example I can give you is I was drilled for easily 3 to 4 hours by a group of Cubans when I was there about credit. They had read about this concept of credit, but had no idea how it worked. So they asked me, we spent the whole evening talking about, and it was a very boring conversation, but interesting to them. They were fascinated, talking about credit cards, bank accounts, mortgages, taxes, these kinds of things.
Gustavo, what do you think about the way that this kind of information is passed along, though?
No, I agree with Delia about that. However, Delia's what Delia can contribute as far as information to Cuban people is somewhat different from an 18 or 19 year old American college student can contribute. And by the way, there are credit cards in Cuba. I know a very well known Cuban writer who has a credit card, an American Express credit card with a very large credit line that he uses when he travels abroad. So that's the point about Cuba. The people, the common people don't know about credit. The government apparatchiks do.
They've all got their credit cards.
Yeah.
All right, Connection listeners. Recent announcement from the Bush administration that educational and cultural exchanges between America and Cuba are going to be, as far as the Bush administration is concerned, brought to an end. Who suffers, who gains by that? We're talking about 44 years into the embargo and what the effect on Cubans and Americans is of that lack of contact. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. I'm Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. A conversation about the ongoing debate over the embargo that separates Cubans and Americans. With me on the program, Delia Poey. She is editor of Iguana Dreams, Little Havana Blues. She is an assistant professor of Spanish at Florida State University. She is joining us from a studio in Tallahassee. Gustavo Perez Firmat is a professor of humanities at Columbia University. He's joining us from a studio at Chapel Hill in North Carolina. He's a poet, a fiction writer, and a scholar. 1994, wrote a book called Life on the Hyphen, 1995, Next Year in Cuba. And you know what strikes me as I listen to the two of you talk is that you both seem to have the same passion for the land and the same passion for the people and the same disdain for the Castro regime. Have you spoken before about what it is that divides you on the embargo? Gustavo, what do you say to Delia when you try to persuade her that the embargo in place is better, that the travel should not happen?
Well, if you knew Delia, you would know that she's impossible to persuade. So I don't. She has very strong and well-founded opinions. No, I my best friends, people like Delia, have all gone back to Cuba. When Cuban exile baby boomers have a midlife crisis, what they do is they go back to Cuba, and I haven't, and I don't plan to until the regime changes. But I understand perfectly well why people would, and it doesn't affect my relationship with them. I also have people that I know inside Cuba, and that I get along with very well, and I don't make. Who am I to judge what kinds of compromises and concessions someone in Cuba has to make in order to keep his family fed or keep himself out of jail. So I distinguish between the
you are in a way standing in judgment by saying that the embargoes.
Because I distinguish between the regime and the Cuban people, and I don't have connections with people who are higher ups in the in the government structure, and these are the people who sort of run the island. But you have 10 million Cubans who are there and have had very tough times and continue to have very tough times and my heart goes out to them.
Well, Delia, do you have any luck making your case to Gustavo?
Well, that's a pretty impossible situation. But the conversations are always interesting because I do think that there is a lot more similarity than there are differences, in that I think most Cuban-Americans, I don't want to say all because I'm sure there's an exception, but most Cuban-Americans and Cuban exiles, of course, want to see Cuba move to a democracy. I think the differences within the community really have to do with the means of achieving that, so that it's not as contentious as it would seem to the outside. I think the real shame of it, though, is that as a first speaker today, Terry Carl, was talking about the Cuban-American community, I think a lot of times the Cuban-American community is painted as monolithic, as one very loud group, all with the same opinion. And I don't think that that's true at all.
Did that during the days of the Elian Gonzalez thing. You remember that? So they think this and they think that. I remember that.
Right. And those are dangerous stereotypes. I think Gustavo and I are probably better examples in that, there's all kinds of different levels within the community. And some of it has to do with generation. Some of it just has to do with political leanings. But I think we all want the same thing in the end. It's really the means that separates us. While I would favor a lot of contact with Cuba and free flow of information, goods, people, et cetera, as a means to achieve it, Gustavo might say that that a more severe distant relationship would be better. But I think we all want the same thing in the end, which is a transition to democracy.
All right. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Cary, North Carolina. Paul's on the line. Hi, Paul.
Hello. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
A very interesting debate today. I had a few comments. I appreciate all the points made by the speakers, but I feel in general that to ban these educational person-to-person trips is kind of a red herring. The broader issue, in my view, is whether we should drop the embargo or not. And furthermore, if these trips are no more than vacations, well, why can't Americans vacation in Cuba? I'd love to be able to go to Cuba freely. And I feel Terry Carl's point that our policy against Cuba is really a political issue, and it's designed, in effect, not to offend the Cuban power elite in Florida. I think that has some validity, although I do agree with Gustavo. I'm horrified by the recent executions and the repression there, but I feel the best way to change that is to let Americans go to Cuba. Let's have normal relations. Let's have educational trips. Let's let them see what democracy and capitalism is like.
Gustavo, I'm going to have you speak to Paul.
Yeah, I agree with you, Paul, but that's a two-way street. For that to be able to take place, the Cuban government itself has to be as open as the American government
would
be.
But I don't think they're going to be as open as we are until we show openness toward them. I think we have to make the first step. Let's let our people go there. Let's have normal trade. And then I think their society and their government may convert. Obviously, the embargo, as you agree, is not working. And to hold on to it for sentimental, nostalgic, or symbolic reasons, as you mentioned, I just feel is not there's not good reasons to keep the embargo in place.
No, I think you have a point. What I would be afraid of is that the Cuban government would take advantage of our openness to perpetuate itself. They said they would use our gestures and would profit from our gestures, and that the end result would be not a more open society in Cuba, but actually a more rigid and long-lasting regime.
Can you give us an example of how that would happen, how they would exploit our openness or our free trade
Let's talk about the educational tours. Americans are subsidizing the Cuban government. If you want to go to Cuba, you have to deal with the state. I can't go to Cuba and, go to an independent educational entity because there are no such independent educational entities. And so, I'm a student, I go to the University of Havana. Okay, I pay with dollars. I pay the Cuban government with the dollars. The Cuban government gets those dollars, and then they, in turn, pay their hand-picked professors with pesos. Okay, so these programs, I am, in effect, subsidizing the Cuban government. It's an act of complicity with the Cuban government.
All right, Paul, thanks a lot for your call. Appreciate that. Let's go to Pocatello, Idaho, and Luis is joining us. Hi, Luis.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm well. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thank you for letting me talk in the radio. Appreciate that.
What's on your mind?
Well, one thing I believe is absolutely that, first, when I came here from Cuba to the United States, I said, this is a country of freedom, and then it shocked me when I was told that Americans couldn't go to Cuba. So it's kind of frustrating for me to understand that. But second, I believe that...
Luis, how long ago did you come to the U.S.?
8 years ago.
Okay.
And the second thing is I really believe that if things open to Cuba, especially if people can go to Cuba and show them how the life and the freedom works in here, people can learn from that. And actually, that's what happened in Germany a long time. Well, when the communism just fell, and also in Russia, I think people going to those countries and showing what's going on here is a lot of help to overthrow probably Castro and the communism.
Do you think at this point in his regime anything's going to overthrow Castro?
Well, embargo doesn't work. I believe so. It's been more than 30 years, and Castro is still in power. And if somebody suffered, it's not Castro; it's actually the people.
Yeah, Luis, thanks for your call. Delia, do you think anything can be done, should be done, or will be done to change the fate of Fidel Castro? Is it just a matter of waiting the man out?
Well, evidence seems to show it's a matter of waiting him out. But I do think that the changes will come from within the island, and there were signs of that happening with the Varela Project and with the pro-democracy movement within Cuba that the recent crackdowns have attempted to stop. And I think that travel and openness and free flow of information to Cuba will aid in that. And like I say, I think the benefit of this exchange is greater for the Cuban people than it is for the Americans who are doing the traveling. In that the Americans are going to pick up a limited amount of information on Cuba simply because of the way that Cuba is structured, while the Cuban people can really take advantage of the information that that American travelers have. In terms of the U.S. Changing its stance and dropping the embargo and Cuba following suit, I don't see that happening. But then again, the U.S. is supposed to be held to a higher standard. The U.S. and Cuba are very different, and that's a good thing for the U.S., I do believe that in dropping the embargo, the Cuban government will not have that excuse, and the Cuban people can then see that it is, in fact, about freedom and about exchange and about a change in systems. So that's why I see it as a positive step, though I don't have great faith that the Cuban government will take positive steps in that direction until they are forced to by their own people.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I wonder if I could get both of you to react to the line that I read from Mr. Navarro, aide to Jeb Bush, who said Castro would be foolhardy to mess with a resolute George W. Bush, that the administration has taken care of one tyrant already. Gustavo, do you think that something will change? Do you think that means anything?
I hope something will change. I don't think it will be for that reason. Cubans have been waiting for the Marines to land on the shores of the Malecón for the last 44 years. And like many other Cubans, I came to this country in the 60s, and we stayed in a hotel for 6 months waiting for the Marines, to go to land in Havana. and remove the government. Well, here we are after 44 years still waiting. So I think that's just, you know, that's similar. The kind of thinking that produces that statement is the kind of thinking also that leads to this kind of sentimental attachment to the embargo. As an American, I don't see what business the United States has in Cuba trying to topple the government. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of governments around the world that may be repulsive to us, but if it's not in our national self-interests to do something about them, then what happens in Cuba is up to, you know, is primarily the responsibility of Cubans both inside and outside the island.
Delia, do you sense a shift in thinking in Washington if the tours are being shut down and there's a sort of puffed-up chest sense of, hey, look what we did in Iraq? Do you think it'll have any effect on U.S. policy as it regards to Cuba?
I really don't think so. I really do think it's just rhetoric. And I think it's playing to, as Gustavo says, to that sentimental attachment to a return to Cuba, mm-hmm. Brought about by the United States. But I really don't think that that the United States is going to do anything about it, and I don't think George Bush is either. And I agree that I don't think it would be a wise move, other than, you know, for Cuban Americans and for Cubans. But in the broader interest of the United States, I don't see how that would fit in. So I think it's just posturing and rhetoric.
Where it does pop up in politics, then, right?
If I may interject, mm-hmm. one thing. Also, whenever the Castro regime topples, changes, ends, it will have happened too late. People ask me, well, what do you think is going to happen? I said, well, I don't know what's going to happen, but whatever happens, it will have happened too late. Huh. Because the people for whom it would have been most meaningful to have that regime change, the people who would have returned to Cuba, is not my generation or Delia's generation, it's the generation of my parents. And that's the generation that's passing away. You know, people like to count the number of Cubans that live in Miami, but to me, equally significant is the number of Cubans who have died in Miami. And Miami is a Cuban city, not because of the Cubans who live in Miami, but because of the Cubans who die in Miami. And for them, the change will have come too late.
You've both been very gracious with your thoughts and ideas. Gustavo, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Gustavo Perez-Firmat's a professor of humanities at Columbia University. Delia, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Delia Poe is a professor of Spanish at Florida State University. Earlier in the hour, we listened to Terry Carl. She's a professor of political science at Stanford University. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Support.